Here in the Music and Dance Building for a presentation by ethnomusicologist and photographer John Cohen.
Something else. I don't know what to call it, so I won't try. musicology, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
But it's applied as opposed to what?
Academic.
What?
Academic.
Academic. Have you all been academics? You have to be academic before you can be applied?
Yeah.
It's a prerequisite to be academic before. So in a way, they shape your mind before you go out in the world. Yeah. That's interesting as can be. Because that's what academia is. That's why you were sent to college. Now, I thought, since it's an ethnomusicology class, that I would try to just say something about ethnomusicology, to put a big, big, big framework around this, and then forget about it. I may be older than ethnomusicology as a field. It's a young field, relatively. I think it really didn't get the name. It didn't have its journal until the 50s, or maybe even the 60s. Do you know for sure, Tom?
The name comes from the outcomes of the Dutch.
Right, but the Society for Ethnomusicology is relatively newer. Before that, the urge, the desire to know about it, this kind of music was there. It was really called world music. Now they use world music again for some other reason. It's a different definition. My father-in-law, Charles Seeger, was one of the founders of the Society for Ethnomusicology. He's also the father of Pete Seeger, Peggy Seeger, Mike Seeger, and all the Seegers. He viewed ethnomusicology, the need to have ethnomusicology, as a correction to musicology. He was a musicologist. So we've got to form this new field to correct the mistakes that are being made in musicology. And they figured that once they corrected the mistakes, then the two would come back together and would be one field. Instead, they went off in different directions. Well, in recent years, now musicology is starting to look at world music very seriously. But that wasn't there at the outset. And at the outset, the definition of ethnomusicology was studying high art music of non-Western cultures. And you can almost trace it in music schools in America. Those who had the first gamelons were the first ethnomusicology departments. There was only one or two. And now there's a great many. But ethnomusicology looked at Javanese music, Balinese music, and music from India. Maybe some African, but not much. It was a high art music was first, then they included primitive music, which is a very degrading phrase, but they used that. And then they would say, and also some folk music, just a little. And the idea of popular music being part of it was absolutely not there. Now, as I understand where people's minds are at now, it's almost reversed that sequence. I mean, so many people interested in ethnomusicology are getting at it through popular music, world popular music. So this is an interesting history, and I just wanted to say that. So if anybody wants to, please ask questions or challenge me. Realize I know all that stuff. And actually, I'll spot one early story that I think will take away that framework. Back in 1932, at the New School for Social Research in New York City, Charles Seeger and a man named Henry Cowell were teaching the first course in world music, in America at least. Now, I've told you who Charles Seeger was. How many of you have ever heard of Henry Cowell? Can you say something, Tucker?
Not at all, nothing.
Okay. Do you want to?
Well, he was, his mother was an anarchist.
His mother was a what?
I think it was an anarchist, and he was invented the tone clusters, I think.
He did that?
I believe so.
Yeah.
And Bartok asked to borrow it, and he was using his work. He was one of the first composers to try to employ, to use non-Western music in his compositions.
Right, and sometimes he'd get inside the piano and bang around, or hit it with his elbows, or with a hammer, or all kinds of inventive things. And he became John Cage's teacher later. I think John Cage is within your scope. It's interesting, these you know, where the radar is pointing, or if you have, you even have radar yet. So there you have Henry Cowell interested in world music, and Charles Seeger, and they're teaching this course at the middle school. And there's a man painting murals out in the hallway. His name is Thomas Hart Benton. He says, you guys don't know what you're talking about. You haven't included any American music. Well, America doesn't have any ethnographic music, ethnic, great music. So, oh yeah, come listen to some old 78s. And Thomas Hart Benton played people like Doc Boggs, the early hillbilly recordings, the really great stuff. Henry Cowell's assistant in painting his murals was a young harmonica player and painter named Jackson Pollock. So I love that moment when all those things were in the same place at the same time, but they didn't know what was going on. And I, you know, as I put my book together, and I'm going to show you all these slides, I realized in a strange way, all those things are reconverging again in my life and then in my daughter's life. And it's very interesting how that happens. So I just want to say that sort of as a personal framework to what we're going to dive into. I started off as a painter, went to art school at Yale, switched to photography. And I could talk for a long time about why that switch was made. But I won't. Yeah, maybe eventually. That's at one end. In this past year, I retired from teaching about 7 years ago, or 6 years ago, and to work on my own work again. I was a professor at Purchase College for 25 years in photography and in other things, drawing and stuff like that. Well, I thought it would be good to get back to practicing what I preached. In other words, to do my work instead of talking about it. So now I'm talking about it. But in this past year, which is really interesting, yeah, my new book just came out. By the way, there's a paperback edition just came out now. The whole back is written by Patti Smith. You know Patti Smith, singer? She flipped out over the book, so we put that on the back. Then, a few months ago, I had a big exhibition at the Textile Museum in Washington, D.C., of Peruvian parrots, of which I am there in one small place. And then the curator there and myself got together, and it's a big show, and it's a big book full of photographs and textiles, and I know a lot about that as well. Each thing that I get involved in, I go as far as I possibly can. It gets confusing sometimes, but I'm not, the specialists appreciate what I've done, but I'm not a specialist in one thing. Does that make sense? I think you might know what that feels like. And then they had a show in Chicago last summer of vintage prints of my photographs from Peru from 1957. It was a show that was held in New York City at the time when there was only one photography gallery in New York City and none in the rest of the country. And I had a show there. And nobody was interested in buying that work, so I put it in a box and I took it out now, 50 years later, almost 45 years later. And now they're all very valuable vintage prints. Vintage is better than just prints. So I'm vintage. It's really strange to see yourself. So these are presented as vintage prints from, I'm a piece of history here. It's a very curious feeling. But all this happened in the last year, so that's exciting. I'm coming around again. Not that I was ever out. I started in New Haven as an art student. I became a photographer. Maybe I'll talk a little bit about that as the slides go on. I got involved in gospel music. I got involved in weaving. See, I'd always loved to play music. When I was in high school, I was the only one who played a guitar and a banjo. There was nobody else. That's how, that was the lonely field that was in then. Of course, later it all got wonderful and exciting. And then in 1958, after I graduated from college, a few years later, after my trips to Peru, I formed this band, the New Lost City Ramblers. It's very interesting to have Becky talk. Is it Becky or is it Professor Miller? Professor Miller talk about my band as an important point in the folk revival. See, in our minds, we were the enemy of the folk revival. When we started, there was groups like, you might have never heard of the Kingston Trio and the Limeliners and all that, and the Weavers even, and we didn't like that. We said, no, we're interested in traditional music, the authentic music that we way the music was originally conceived of, the style in which it's played. So we chose, or we're attracted to, Appalachian music, Southern music. But the example that we set worldwide is really interesting. I've heard it from Irish bands, people who were young people in Ireland who heard our music and said, wow, these guys from the city can play the rural music and really get off on it. We gave them permission to do the same thing. I've heard that story a lot. In a way, we were, I like to think about us as not being just playing old-timey music, but pointing the direction away from these staged interpretations of traditional music and actually allowing ourselves to perform it and making it part of our lives. So these are all the things that flowed into me being who I am today. Along the way, also, I felt, besides taking my photographs, I felt an urge to document the music, to make recordings of it. Maybe I was never satisfied with anything. Here's a recording that just came out 2 months ago. It's music of a wonderful gospel singer named Blind Gary Davis. These are recordings I made in 1953 and sat on them all these years. He became so famous that I forgot that my recordings were anything. It turns out they're very good. And there's a lot of music on here that he never played afterwards. Because this is when he was still part of the black community in New York City before he became part of the folk blues revival. So I did that. This is one that just came out last month. Roscoe Holcomb, who you'll hear more about during this. Here's a record I did back in 1959. And these are all been reissued on CD now. Mountain Music of Kentucky. 30 pages of notes and 30 pages of photographs, and just a way of expressing all these things. Here's one called High Atmosphere. It's ballads and banjo tunes from Virginia and North Carolina. And did any of you hear a band called Wilco? They've been picking up songs off of this album. It's very interesting. This is Roscoe Holcomb again. His album's called The High Lonesome Sound. Any of you heard that phrase, the High Lonesome Sound? I made it up for a movie that I did about Roscoe. And if we have time, I'll show you that movie at the end of the class. And then this thing, which is the companion to the book. After I did the book of photographs, I realized I had all these recordings of so many of the musicians. So that I thought I would put that together. So you could, I didn't want it to be part of the book, but it's a separate item. Got the Gospel Church, Reverend Gary Davis, a little girl in the Carolina Sea Islands. These are the first three photographs. I Can't Be Satisfied by Muddy Waters, Roll On John by Bob Dylan, Man of Constant Sorrow by Roscoe Holcomb, then Dawson, then the Stanley Brothers, an Irish Gypsy, Alice and Hazel, some bluegrass women, Bill Monroe, Eck Robertson. It just goes on and on. That's a little bit of a New Law City Ramblers, even has Alan Lomax singing, Woody Guthrie singing, and a Peruvian band. So if you want to say who I am, I really appreciate that, because I can't tell you which one is me. I'm all these things, and I'm interested in all these things. I think today we're talking about applied ethnomusicology, and I'm a photographer. Okay. I think the word that people generally apply to this or think about would be, oh, he's a documentary photographer, And the only way I can qualify that is a wonderful quote by Walker Evans. Any of you ever hear of Walker Evans? Great photographer, very important. He's gotten more and more important as time goes on. He said, I work in a documentary style. Documentary style. That doesn't mean he's a documentary photographer, but that his work is in a documentary style. It has an assumption that documentary is just a style among other styles, or has a certain look. That's a very tricky statement. I think some of you have photographs that we'll look at together at the end of the class. Is that right? Are you documentary photographers? What are the other choices? Did you start
that? Not a photographer at all.
What's that?
Not a photographer at all.
But you took some photographs.
Yes.
Okay. It would be interesting to see. And how about you all?
Yeah, everyone in Becky's class, we did an assignment today, which is what we'll be looking at.
Everybody did it?
Yeah, the ones that are in Becky's class and not the other
ones. Uh-huh. But I don't even want to ask what the assignment was, but how many of you came up with the issue, is this documentary, am I being a documentary, or am I being something else? Did the word flash across your mind at all? You know, you have to be something. When you put the frame, you could like a frame, there's a picture of this guy, wide frame of the whole class, or a panorama or something. You know, you've got to put yourself somewhere. So, is my boyfriend or my girlfriend, or here's my mother, or my little ratty kid sister, or here is a group of students, or here is the citizens of the United States, or here is the military, or what? You know, you're forced to think about something when you put a frame around it. By the way, I got to say something about putting frames around things. I'm just getting remembered what I could say.
Oh, yeah.
Believe it or not, Western civilization, the one that we're in, the one that we're all born in, most of us, is the only culture that has a frame around pictures. All other image making in the world, in every other culture in the world, never used that frame. And up till the Renaissance in Italy, they never had the frame around things. Art was sculptures. Architecture, it was murals, it was on fabrics, it was on pottery, it was on the side of a box. It was never in a frame. And once they put it in a frame, then they could even put the frame on an easel, and all these other, they could then take it and sell it. It could become a commodity. But when it was on a wall, it was part of a building. So the whole meaning of life changed with that frame. You read, if any of you read the reading that I didn't assign, but I gave some suggestions. I think they talk about an experiment that some anthropologists did in Chicago, where they gave movie cameras to Navajos. It's called Through Navajo Eyes. They said, if you give these guys the camera and don't tell them how to use it, or just tell them how to load the film, not tell them about making a shot and not thinking about sequencing film or anything like that, we'll be able to see through their eyes. And they got a lot of money to make that study, and it was talked about, there's lots of articles about it. For me, the films are really boring. But the trick is this, that once anybody picks up the camera and accepts that frame, which is inherent in the still camera and the movie camera, then you're putting that frame around it, and you're already involved in Western thinking. As soon as you accept that. So I just want to say that. But I accept it. I accept the frame. I had something else in my heart, or my soul, or my liver, or whatever. So let's look at some pictures, and please interrupt me, because I'm talking too much. I've heard what I've had to say, but I'd love to hear some challenges. So let's see what comes up. I guess we can turn the lights out. You have to give remember that? Not really. She said, well, I used to sit in the back of the room by the projector. I remember one time you said, it's okay to fall asleep in class, but not to snore. I said, oh, yeah. Well, nice to meet you. I said, what's she telling me? She's telling me that she slept through the class and that she couldn't hear what I was saying because she was sitting next to the projector. And yet she also said, this is my favorite class. I learned more in that class than any class. I said, how can that be? And I realized by saying what I said, especially about sleeping, I gave her permission not to pay attention. She could just take what she wanted. I wasn't going to give her a quit. I wasn't forcing her into what to think about. So that's interesting. So you can sit closer, further, whatever you like. And I'll shout. Now that you've had a chance for the picture to sink in, any question? Yes?
Well, it's just, you know, I see this moment with a very ambiguous conflict in as a viewer, whether it's play acted violence or not. There's this implicit violence, the kid with the military stance with the pop gun or whatever it is, the children scrambling the overturned car. There's this image that if they were adults would be violent.
Yeah.
But because they're children, and I'm hoping it's play, that there you're right on a weird line there that causes it to be an unsettling.
Yeah, and that's very close to, not why I took it. I took it because I was intrigued by what it was. I didn't know what it was. But as I look at the picture over the years, I keep coming back to that place.
Well, and in the moment, as Creel Marcus's introduction pointed out, in the moment, you would not probably feel ambiguous about whether it's play or whether it's violence. You were there, you could see they were playing, or you were there, you could see it was violent. But the frozen image is much more ambiguous.
And I was there to record and film children's games that were based on African patterns in the Carolina Sea Islands. And I thought, you know, for this class, I'll bring that side out of it as well. Why I was there. But all those things are correct. And, you know, for those of you who were, no, you weren't around in the Civil Rights Movement, but there was a lot of photographs like this in the newspapers all the time. Somebody with a gun and somebody being hosed down or running away. Of course, these kids are smiling, and he's very innocent at the same time he's in the aggressive pose. Of course, the overturned car is a car that's on its side. And probably suggest. Anyhow, I like the photograph because of all these things keep coming at me, and the sun was setting at the same time. And if any of you are taking any art history classes, this little girl has a pose that in Hildesheim Cathedral in Germany, there's a carving of the expulsion from the Garden of Eden, and that's the position that Eve is in. When God's hand comes out, he points it straight like this. It's the same pose. I mean, I didn't ask her to take that pose, but it emerged in the photograph. Now, I'm telling you all these things because photography can happen that way. You can have a response to what's in front of you, but you never know what's going on. Next slide. The designer of the book put this as one of the very first photographs. And at the same time she was doing that, it was hanging on the wall at the Metropolitan Museum. And she didn't know about that. And I thought that was intriguing that people would use this for whatever purpose they wanted. Do you get anything from it? What comes to mind? Tom, you've spoken already, so you can't speak again. Of course, maybe he's the only one with a mind. No. Anybody? Just say a word. Yeah?
Well, I'm curious about the way in which you're asking the audience to produce meanings from the images as opposed to deciding to contextualize these images for us. I'm curious about why you've chosen to present your work in this way, and in fact, is it just in this context that you do that, or do these photographs in the book have titles, do they have dates, do they have
see the caption under the picture. And I never give names to the pictures.
So you want your viewer to have a kind of phenomenal response to the image without providing the context or the entry to understand
it? Well, I think each person's context, of what they bring to it, is so valuable. It's more, maybe it's even more valuable than the, quote, truth, the documentary quality. But eventually the documentary quality is there.
Well, I think historically it's a kind of interesting moment in the history of photography because, in the 90s, the 80s and the 90s, there was a lot of theoretical work that critiqued photography for its lack of, especially documentary work and the tradition of documentary work, for being, to a certain extent, irresponsible, and that a person who perhaps was working out of the documentary tradition had the responsibility, needed to be responsible for contextualizing the image, because the photograph can be an image without a code, and that we, in a sense, have to provide that code in order to be able to read it. And I remember, so there's a kind of a swinging back at this moment in the ways in which photography is being talked about, and it's a kind of a coming together of the phenomenal along with a kind of a responsible.
But what comes to my mind, I just can't let go by, in those days, documentary had the reputation of being only contextualizing, only, it was almost called photography. Documentary photography was like propaganda. That's what Neil Marcus is referring to. He said, all these photographers, these great photographers in the past, they were making arguments. They were telling you what to see. And that you couldn't find that in my work, which is intriguing. But it's doubly complicated because you're talking about the critique of the 80s and 90s. And I put this book together now in the zeros. But the photographs were taken in the 50s and the 60s. So there's no, it's a moving target. And I'm both the shooter and the target are moving. And that's fine. I like to hear all this. In honor of your request, this was one of the very first emergency signs of pop art. I was part of the art world in New York in the late 50s and the early 60s. This is the painter Red Grooms as a young man putting on a performance. This was a happening. Any of you study art history or art classes? You should. If you're going to be a photographer, you've got to know what the artists are thinking about. Anyhow, I'm just inflicting that on you. All right, next photograph. Yeah, this isn't even sharp anywhere. This is out of focus all the way through. I like this for early in the book because it's like, to me, it's like an existentialist photograph. Two men having a discussion at the end of the world, or the edge of the city. Of course, it's New York City. And the person on the left is the photographer, Robert Frank, who some of you may have heard of. And the guy on the right turns out to be the painter, Larry Rivers, who just died recently. You may know of him. But I didn't, that's not the reason I took the picture. I like the atmosphere and the idea of having a conversation at the end of the world. Next slide. This is how we got our work around in those days. It was used on the cover of a poetry magazine, one of the first beat generation New York poetry magazines. Cut out the type and pasted it right on the photograph. No Photoshop, no computers. That was the way we did it. Cheap. Next slide. Next gun. And if you couldn't afford the type, you could just see it out there in the street. I'm not getting too many comments yet, but it's all right. What's the first thing that pops in your head when you see this? Anything familiar there at all, besides Times Square?
The smell of
what's that?
The smell of what's
wet. It's wet, yeah. What? Yeah.
I don't know the context of the photograph, but the lettering at the back, even though it doesn't actually say 333, because of all of the E's, it makes me feel like that's what it's saying. And then again, like was said with the first one, it makes me feel like it's a political statement, whether it is or not.
actually right now we're hearing interesting things. We're hearing the theoretical mind and the contextual mind, and you're all groaning and grunting in agreement. Why couldn't you say it's an eye chart?
Actually, I agree with you. It's interesting that you thought it had a political meaning, but given what I know about Times Square in New York City, it occurred to me that that might be a possibility. But no, Times Square, strictly commercial, you know? And so I thought it's an advertisement for some play on Broadway. I completely intellectualized it from, you know, political interest to the reality of what I know about Times Square today.
And yet, everybody sighed when I said, an eye chart, and they said, oh, yeah, that's good. And to me, it was very surreal to see that big eye chart in the middle of New York City by just taking an advertisement for some big movie and just deconstructing, destroying it, just shoving one edge of it forward and became something else. That's slightly magical. Photography can do slightly magical things if you're open to that. Next slide. These are very personal photographs of mine, I guess. This is one of the only photographs that I have that I can't find the negative to. I have two old prints, and I went and did the dirty thing, and I had a digital negative made because a copy negative wouldn't work. This is a print from a digital negative. Well, it's my take on digital. Digital helped me out in that respect.
It has.
And it helped me document my own work. I have now a piece of film that I can put into my enlarger and print on silver gelatin paper and get a beautiful print, which became a picture, which became a slide, which becomes an image on a wall here. But why did this guy take this photograph? What is it about? Is it about anything? If somebody tried to analyze it as a phenomenon or as a bunch of stuff.
I think it's a picture of what you can't see in the venue.
What?
It's a picture of what you can't see in the venue.
What you can't see?
It's a picture of what you don't know is going on.
But is anything going on? If you
hadn't.
What?
I don't know. I mean, is it a psychic? Is it cookies? For me, the van is central in the shot, and that I don't know half the words on it, and I can't see what's going on in what I can see of the van. And this man is intrigued.
He's intrigued by what's going on, but we don't know what it is. Does anybody read Spanish? Well, Tom, you can read Spanish.
Not enough, but just, again, the camera freezing an odd moment. It almost appears as if the living person and the image of a person are locking eyes, thereby giving her, La Sultana, her picture anyway, sort of a living space within the frame. Also, dead center, you have La Sultana and her gaze, but it seems as if her gaze is strong enough to draw the gaze of the passerby. And there's a relationship between the two of them all of a sudden.
Yeah, and the photograph is absolutely symmetrical. Not totally, but it lines up right down the middle. The two cars line up, he and she line up. It's very strange. But then there's a little side event. It's like, who's that woman in the car? And what's that sculpture to the left? Oh, it's a parking meter. I mean, things put in this kind of framework pick up a new meaning, at least they did for me, or do for me. And then it took time to realize part of that in the middle of the city thing, in this mechanized place where I lived, all over Third Avenue in New York, there's this hand-painted woman on the side of the truck. And she's talking about biscuits. And she's La Sultana de Borniquin. Anybody know what Borniquin is? Yes?
It's a Puerto Rican.
It's the old name of Puerto Rico, yeah. The Indian name, I think. And so there it is in the middle of New York City. I thought all these things were just worth digging into. And I found that enough for that day. All right, next slide.
Can I just ask a question?
Yes, please.
Did you take that leaning out of your apartment window?
My loft window,
okay.
Yeah. Sure.
So you observed the scene. You said you thought that was interesting. You sounds like some of the way you what you said, it sounds like you comprehended all of this before.
Oh, I didn't comprehend any of it.
Okay.
None of it. I just was, I said, look at this. And I couldn't even, there wasn't any time to think about
right,
it.
Right, that's what I was thinking.
That's right. You've heard of Cartier-Bresson's comment, the decisive moment. Ever heard that? That's applied to photography. Photography is about the decisive moment. Well, that certainly was a decisive moment, but I didn't have time to decide. Mm-hmm. I just.
So you just kind of hung out your window?
I hung out my window. Well, actually, it was through the window. I didn't hang out. Yeah, I mean, if you're feeling like taking a photograph, you take a photograph. That's a great. Indulgence in this very applied life that we live in. I advocate, but I can't afford it either. Next slide. Yeah, this is when I was still an art student, and the camera was pulling me out of the studio, out of the painting studio, and into the streets of New Haven. And I just—it's such an instinctive moment. I mean, the wall was in the air. The little girl is off the ground. She almost feels like to me now. Feels almost like she's pasted on like a collage. And I find that happens in some of my other photographs. It's just things that you have within you that come again and again. And the kind of guy, the sort of beaten guy, looking on. And we have a Mark Rothko painting back here. And we have a couple of John Cage dancers going here. And I mean, all those things for me. And of course, a little bit of Jackson Pollock down here with this little thing. Of course, there wasn't time to plan it. As a matter of fact, I have a whole bunch of photographs that I took just from that one position. I stood in the street and into the swing room to see what I could see within that climate. You know, there's no Coca-Cola sign, there's no advertising. It's just one of the great things about areas that aren't controlled by the media or by advertising. Just things happen. Allows things to happen to the artist as well. Are we talking about artists or no? Pardon me, to the ethnographer. Next slide. Yeah, that was just right next, just across the street from where that little girl was. This was a family of gypsies, and I'd go in and take photographs and talk to them. And actually, one of the great moments in my whole education. 7 years of college, you know, one undergraduate, five in the art school, and in the final year, the visiting critic in New York came up and looked at my paintings and said, "Too tough, but stick with it, and I'll get better." I couldn't work that right. So I went back to my apartment, took out my camera, emptied my pockets of all my money except 47 cents. See, every time I went to the gypsies' place, they would work for me for whatever money I had. They'd get whatever money I had on them. And so that day, I went there and they got my money and stuck it down in the clothes where I couldn't get it back. And they took my little mom and looked and said, "Things are tough, but stick with it. It'll get better." I said, "Wow. 7 years of college? Yeah." And for 47 cents, I got this thing. So that's what I'll always remember about this woman. Next slide. This is exactly on the same street. On the same, probably the same day. I don't know what I was excited about. Maybe I couldn't figure out what that shadow was, what was causing that shadow. And much later I realized there's a man out there on the balcony causing the shadow. But then it's sort of, it's very close to the kind of compositions that I was using in my paintings, which were collages in those days, anyhow. But it does look like a documentary photograph, doesn't it? You just can't tell what it's documenting. Sometimes, I've had this question come up a lot of times. I sometimes realize what I'm documenting is the way I feel at that moment. That's a document. caused me to snap it wasn't only what was there, but what was doing to me. This is virtually invisible, and half a second later, it wasn't there. So that's another quality of photography. Thank you. Let's keep going. Next. Yeah, even this, which I was just in Penn Station. This is the old Penn Station before they tore it down. It used to have beautiful light. Yes?
I have a question for you that you can put in your photography.
Well, no, I want to hear what you have to say.
I was going to say, do you find yourself critical about people's works, or do you just look at it and sort of see it as it is and the fact it's a documentation?
Other people's works?
I mean, do you find yourself critical as an artist?
Critical of myself or other people?
I guess both would be that.
What?
Both.
Endlessly. I can go through all these and tell you what's wrong with them and how that all fail in things. And I can look at other people's work and say, oh my God, they're really at a great place, or else they didn't know what they were doing. Or some of them, they're just doing it because it's been done, or they're doing it because they want to sell it. These are things that I see. Or some people are doing it because they're in the trend. Some people are, you know, they're trying to be fashionable or catch up with where things are now. Some are going deep inside themselves. I'm always looking for something individual. And is that sort of what you're asking? Maybe it's something else.
Yeah, I just found it interesting when you were describing your process and like what inspired you to take these pictures. I was just wondering, like, sometimes it seemed to have a certain like ambiguity, like you weren't quite sure why you took it or what you were thinking.
But I would fight, and I would fight today if I could even get back out there in the street and stand there and be that open again. I know too stupid much. I know so much now that inhibits that freedom. These are photographs of someone who is just open. A new tool, a new way of seeing, the opportunity to make images, to deal with the world outside, think about inside. It was an extraordinary time. And you're all at that stage right now.
I'm curious to know, you mentioned your training was as an artist. I'd be curious to know what other photographers might have interested you in, and also if you had what your thoughts are about your relationship to those whom you're photographing. I mean, you have
my relationship to the people who are in that. After this section, that becomes the rest of the day is about them. I promise.
Well, no, I was just asking about that. I wasn't.
Yeah, no, but I think this is, so far it's been pretty good. We've been opening up a whole bunch of avenues. So it's not just one avenue. And you can, I think it slipped a little bit out of focus. We'll see what the next one does if it gets back in focus. There it is. There it is. Do people still work in the dark room with them larger? Oh, here's the next picture. Uh-oh, this is reversed left to right. This may happen to all the rest of them. We'll see. Well, that's kind of interesting. I've never seen it this way. You turn the slide projector around. No, again, it's a moment that's really hard to define what it's about. It's a little boy and a little girl. The little girl is my daughter, and that's a friend of hers. And the two horses were two horses. And I don't know what it says. I don't know what it says. Yes?
So, I'm thinking about your photographic process. And
my photographic process?
Yeah, the process. And I mean, essentially, you're taking photos that are aesthetically pleasing once they become photos, and it's like seeing what you see, and like,
one of them is in their own world. That's that, you know, now that you ask the question, each in their own world. And that's maybe essentially what it is, although it's partly a visual world. But it's like, why don't I have no idea why I thought of the floor present overhead or what Aaron is doing there. And the horses, they don't speak. But it felt good together. It's an intuitive thing, and it's tremendously personal. And I like the setting. I like that it's just on great rings. That'll come up several more times in other photographs. That's just part of who I happen to be. And when I look at your work, I'll see who you might be also. But you don't have to be me. Next slide. Oh, this is reversed also. They all might be reversed now. One of the reasons I got into photography and out of painting was that there was, I had made some recordings of Gary Davis. Remember those early CDs I showed you? And the photography professor, his name is Herbert Matter, great photographer, great graphic designer. And he's a Swiss man and he was in America. And he was involved in doing films about jazz dancing. And then he was doing a film in gospel churches. And he wanted to know if there's any students who could help him. And none of the students at Yale at the time knew anything about that, but they knew about my recordings. So he came and heard my recordings and asked me to do the sound of the movie. So I brought a camera with me because he was a photography teacher. And that's how I got into photography. And these are some of the pictures that I took during his session. It's very upsetting to me that they're backward. Let's see, the next one's backward, but I'm going to have to do something about it. Can we see the next one? Oh, that's right, okay. And after I took photographs with his film, then I started going out on my own to gospel churches. I heard some gospel singing when I was a little kid. I heard spirituals when my father used to carry me around. He'd sing them. I don't know why. I didn't know what the difference between any song and a Negro spiritual was. But it kind of set me up a little bit. But eventually, I think, on this occasion, I had gone up to Harlem on Sunday morning because I just needed to hear that music. And I walked around and I could hear it up on like the fifth floor of the building. I wouldn't do this today, but I just went into the building and climbed the five flights and knocked on the door. I could hear the music in there. Nobody answered, so I opened the door and there were six people in there and five of them were in a trance. And so they told me to come back later. One person who was not in a trance. And I did come back later and worked out some kind of human relationship where it would be all right for me to come and visit and photograph. So this is one of the photographs that came later. But the amount of sound and music that was going on in the room is just, it's an incredible experience. If you haven't had it, you should have it. Next slide. Now, it's odd to me now because I just put together the recordings of this music and it's so loud and strong, and yet it's so quiet when you look at the screen here. It's such a strange visual statement there. Hitting the tambourine, I think, or a couple of cymbals. Well, next. This is Reverend Gary Davis. Now, here we get a little bit into the photographer as documenter of the setting of music. If any of you know Gary Davis's music, you'll see, and have seen the photographs that come up, he's always either on stage or backstage with white folks around him or in the spotlight. And in my simple-minded early days, I just said, I'd like to walk around with him and see how he spends the day, see what he does. He'd play the guitar in the street. He'd beg sometimes. He'd go in the corner store and play. And that's what this was. But, so if anybody knows his music, this is where the context, the setting in which his music happens. Tom, you seem to be knowing what I'm talking about. And you know the other photographs as well.
Gary Davis, I've seen many photographs of, yes.
But never
not like this, no.
Yeah, not in his own ambience. That's a strange. That's part of my total aesthetic. It turns out, if it's an aesthetic. But for those of you were field workers in ethnomusicology. There I was documenting the social setting of this man's music. Okay, next slide. How's that going? What I can't figure out is how I was taking photographs and making recordings at the same time. They're good recordings. And I know this is about where I was sitting, and I pull the microphone up, and if you're singing, I hold it a little higher, and somebody else is singing, I pull it back. It's not the way they make recordings these days. But, any of you play the guitar? Well, what's going on here? All you pickers? This is a document of Gary Davis making his noise, the sound, by hammering down on the neck of his guitar and clicking his finger in the air. He's not picking the strings. This is musicological information. And it went right by until I pointed it out. How am I supposed to do that?
Well, I think it's really interesting that he obviously has a really intense right-hand strum because his pick guard, where the pick guard would be,
was
completely chipped away. And so he's obviously nailing his guitar. You know, he's obviously has an intense drum. You can know his music, of course, it makes perfect sense. So it's really interesting to see the visual depiction of his sound. So am I right, Tess? Guitar maker.
Actually, Sean and I were discussing the same point. It's part. I saw it as a big flourish. He's in the middle of a big right hand.
But
big
is he
right
gonna
hand.
Nail it right where all the bars are?
Actually, he rests his fingers there when he's playing with thumb and one finger. The other three fingers have just rubbed there for so long. It's not. He's not a real whack the top of the guitar type of player. But just the fact that the other fingers of his right hand rest there while he's playing is the main cause of that getting eaten away. Believe it or not.
So it tells us that
he
probably had that guitar for a long,
yes.
long, long time.
Well,
maybe
he had a short time and played it.
Yes.
Really
real
long.
Because what I learned from him is that he kept losing guitars. He'd fall asleep in the streets of New York. And people would steal them. And then the community would get together and buy him another guitar. All those things, all those layers are here. And okay, next slide. And you know, as I went down the street following him around, I said, oh, what's this like? A blind man going down the stairs in a darkened stairway carrying a guitar and go out into the street. And Patti Smith writes about this photograph, the glow of the daylight coming through the window. I mean, it's so interesting. And I'm willing to take it at all these levels at once. And I give it to you at all these levels at once. Of course, I like the zigzag structure of the picture anyhow. And it's quite amazing. When my book came out, the New York Times ran this as almost half a page. They wrote about my book. And this photograph suddenly, which was just a personal thing that I'd never ever shown before, suddenly it was there being seen by lots of people. Next photograph. And the next. Yeah.
You mentioned these people are trance earlier. Is this like a drug induced?
No, music induced. Well, not just. I mean, you've gotten to a rock and roll concert without drugs where it really gets to you. This was before rock and roll. This is heavy, heavy stuff, and it's a small room, and everybody's clapping and singing, and when they feel the spirit, they're dancing. And when they get to really to the next point, they're rolling on the ground. But the woman there, the wife, she's the director. She's kind of the church leader. So she's encouraging people to do this kind of activity. That's part of it. Mm-hmm. And when they speak in tongues, that's another whole thing. If you haven't heard it, you should. Yes?
When you took the picture, were you kind of off to the side of the room, or were you moving in throughout their service?
I was there the whole time. Sure.
Right, but I mean, were you the side of the room, you know, just kind of minding your own space, or were you going in?
Like the room wasn't any wider from here to you.
Okay.
That's how could I mind my own space?
Yeah.
I had a had to be there just like you. You're there. We had to share the space. And actually, eventually, when I started making movies, I made 15 films about music. I would use a lens that was a very wide angle lens, and in some of my photographs, I actually, with one hand, I'm holding the camera, and the other hand, I'm touching the people who are talking to me. It's that close sometimes. And the strange thing is, on the screen, they're looking not into my lens, but into my good eye. There's one eye looking into the other one's right here, just a slight angle. So they're all looking slightly off screen, but actually they were looking at my human eye. But that's how close I was to get. I used to think that a telephoto lens would be helpful, get you closer to things that are far away. But it turns out that the wide angle lens is the best one for that. It's a contradiction. Next slide. Someone can spend a lot of time studying how trances work, trance and dance, trances in Haiti, trances in American gospel music. Yeah.
Is she coaxing this other person out of the trance, or do you know
is what?
Is she helping this other person out of the trance here, or?
I don't know, but at least she's making communication. She didn't let her just go off.
So she's kind of stewarding the process in some
fashion. And she's inducing them, getting them to get into it, and then making sure they don't go away. Of course, I didn't ask her. You couldn't ask that. But I've been to a number of things like this in my churches as well. But let's see where we're going. What's next? Oh, yeah, and then I went to Peru. Now, as for my master's degree in painting, they said, you had to write a thesis, and I'd never written. And I couldn't. And you had to write a research paper. And I didn't know what that was, because I just was doing my own stuff. And they said, you go to the library and research it, Tom. And I flipped out. I couldn't stand that idea of wasting a whole year in a library researching something so I could write a paper to get a thesis, so I could get a degree. I didn't know what that was about. But through a series of classes in sociology and in anthropology, social anthropology, and New World archaeology, plus my color classes and my collage classes, I had gotten deep curiosity about Peruvian weaving. Pre-Columbian weaving I found absolutely beautiful, like music. And I don't want to get into that now, but we could talk about it. But that's when I got the idea. Actually, it was during a class, in New World Archaeology, the teacher says, you're given a grant to do work in the New World. What are you going to do with the money? What's your project? So not being the contrarian that I sort of am, said, I would go to the Maya Peninsula, look at the people who are living there now, to see if the way they live now has any resemblance to what the anthropologists and archaeologists tell us how they lived thousands of years ago. See if there's any resemblance. And that became the main question for me. Because I then found myself thinking about these pre-Columbian textiles and said, how do they make these beautiful decisions? How do they get these ideas? How will I ever find out? The books couldn't tell me anything. I'd stand in front of a fabric and get all kinds of ideas. And then I realized, if I went to South America and studied with the descendants of that tradition, maybe I'd get some insight. So that became my master's. Go study with the contemporary Indians to see what they thought about in making their own weaving. Of course, I knew what the old stuff looked like. They didn't, but it was an interesting kind of a dialogue. That gave me something to do. For 6 months, I traveled all through the mountains looking for weaving information. And I set for myself a challenge, since I wasn't a weaver, that I would learn it in their terms. I'd ask them, how do they do it, if I could, in their language. Learn something of their language to see if I could convey it some of that. That was my written thesis. But this gave me the opportunity to go to these wonderful places and take photographs for myself. This is one that I took for myself. I always always liked this photograph, and I couldn't tell why, and then Rila Marcus wrote about it. He said this photograph could have been taken 1,000 years ago, or hundreds of years ago. But it only exists because it's, I photographed it, but there was no photography back then. Some complicated thing. And recently I realized what I was recognizing here. Have you been to the Museum of Natural History, where they have those big dioramas? And these incredible landscapes that go back and they're pure and everything's just right? I said, there's one of them, and I'm standing in it. And then this little kid comes across it. What are you doing? You know. Actually, one time I was taking a photograph of a young man who I knew there. We joke around with him. So he picked up a rock. He started imitating me. That's a form of dialogue. I was making a picture of what he looked like to me, and he was making a picture of what I looked like to him. Next slide. Someone was talking about the gaze before. I don't know what she says to you. I can't even decipher what she says to me, but it's something pretty deep. Yeah, Tom.
Well, and whatever it is, it contrasts so beautifully to the other side of the photo. The child's maybe, not, I won't even say suspicious, but a very different gaze coming over her shoulder from behind.
Yeah, and what I achieved something with her, we were comfortable enough with each other that she could just be herself and I could be taking pictures. Of course, it is dark at that moment. This was the lens was open all the way to 1.1, I think, maybe 1.4, whatever its maximum was. It was a deep twilight. And we were just sitting there enjoying the twilight, watching it get dark.
So these are people that you had a relationship with.
What's that?
These are people that you had a relationship with?
Well, I had talked to her, I stayed at her house. Actually, when she was a little girl, she was in an earlier photograph. I interviewed her about weaving, me off to my face. These are good things. If you could get an informant to tell you off, then you've gotten something.
Did she tell you off or not?
Let's see. I asked her a question like this. I said, when young boys start to do heavy work, that's when they start to chew cocoa leaves. When do young women start to do the picking out the patterns for the weaving? I set the question up that way to see what, if I learned something about how she learned. She says, what do you ask me this kind of nonsense? Who can remember when I was just a young girl running barefoot through the world? Who can remember stuff like that? The mestizos, they spend their lives reading and looking at books, and we spend our lives perfecting our weaving. That time place it was great. Just great. I learned so much from that statement. She knew us. She knew me. Yeah.
Can you speak Quechua?
I'm not Quechua. That means no. But the words that I learned in Quechua, I knew two words before I went to Peru. There used to be a wonderful strange singer named Ima Sumac. Anybody ever hear of Ima Sumac? And she was kind of a contralto with a high range, and she played. She may still be alive. Well, the words Ima Sumac showed me how beautiful. So imagine me walking across the mountains, and there's some lady there on the ground making her weaving. This gringo coming over the mountain. Well, I could have been a menacing character, and I was probably. But I looked at what she was doing and said, Ima Sumac. And she smiled. And then I said, Ima, how? Or Ima Sutifi, what is it called? The name of the loom. Then I take out my notes. Oh, someone said it was this. No, it's this. I write down what she said. But the key words are in Quechua.
So you communicate with them in Quechua?
I communicated with however I could. But always around me, because the world was too big otherwise. But to try, it's a beautiful language, by the way. I regret it for the next 50 years that I never did learn it. If you have the energy, do it. It's wonderful. Yes?
Chronological. Are we looking
not looking at it chronologically, but I'm putting it in a chronology. I'm talking about when I was an art student, when I left for Peru, when I did the gospel pictures, and so in a way, it is slightly chronological that way, but not picture by picture.
Okay, and I just wanted to know where in Peru this was.
This is in a region called Queros, Q-E-R-O-S, the book that I did about textiles, is about textiles of that region, and it's, go to Cusco, which was the center of the Inca Empire. You get on a truck for about 8 hours to get to Ocangati, and then 2 days on horseback over that ridge that goes down towards the jungle. And there they are.
And then the third thing that I wanted to say is a comment that knowing that you had some kind of a relationship with the person that you photographed made a difference to me in understanding or reading this image, because initially, when I first saw the image, I wasn't aware that you knew who this person was, but you just had an encounter with this person, and thinking about this as a kind of ethnographic study where, you know, the person behind the camera has a certain kind of authority approaching the subject, but the subject then becomes an object of the photograph. But when you began to speak about the relationship that you had with this person, the object of the photograph became a subject. And so it made a lot of difference to me in hearing you talk about, you know, this person in the photograph. It gave the image other dimensions. And then seeing a series of images from the same place, from the same community, also gives the work another dimension or another layer, as opposed to seeing individual or discrete images, which are just, you know, the kind of decisive moment images, a whole sort of other genre.
But you're arguing for the importance of context here. I mean, that's one of the things that you're talking about, the important, how valuable context can be.
It can be. I mean, it makes a difference in this group of work. It doesn't make such a difference to me in looking at the sort of the earlier work where you're walking, when you're in the street and you're having encounters that have to do with that kind of coming together of time and space, where individuals in the images aren't so important. I'm not really interested in their stories. I'm more interested in how I produce meanings from looking at those images, where I'm having a sort of a more of a kind of phenomenal response to them. But it makes a big difference in looking at this body of work, because you're working with a specific community, and I, in thinking about these images as decisive moments, I have a level of discomfort with that that I don't have when you begin to create a narrative around these images and these people become subjects.
Yeah, no, that's, and someday, if I can ever find a publisher who's courageous enough, I'll put all my Peru work together, because there's a lot of it. There's music, and there's films, and there's textiles, and there's photographs, and there's a lot of it. But if you put it in the right context, you wonder, is anybody interested in that subject? And that's what the publisher would ask. Anyhow, that may happen, it may not happen. Actually, I'm very curious, in the last year or so, I've become a little bit famous because of, you know, the book and the exhibitions and all that. And I suddenly realized that if I become famous enough, then a publisher will say, oh, we can have work by this. You know, maybe we'll get our money back if we put out the book. If I was unknown, they would. So suddenly I have an object. It might be worth it just to be a little famous so I can get the book published. Okay. Ever, any of you hear a book called Let Us Not Raise Famous Men? Actually, that was the assignment, yeah.
Right.
You had a question back there.
I'm just noticing it. I remember, I think it's the first photo that's been a close-up of somebody's face.
Yes.
And I initially had the same reaction as you did. I was concerned about, that's why I asked if you had a relationship, because I was concerned about the idea of presentation or re-presentation of these people. And I was thinking about, I mean, as much as that corner in, was it New York City, where you took several images of one of the shadow?
Oh yeah, no, that was in New York.
You're all jumping.
Yeah.
I mean, as much as that was a community at that given time, this is a community right now, but those pictures were so, I felt like abstracted from them, because they were more wide angle shots of the entire scene, but this is close up, and I felt almost initially like I was worried about what you're listening. I wanted to know that you knew who that was. I didn't want that to be a moment that you saw, you know, a girl jumping into her, and she became almost like just a shape. I wanted this to be like a human.
And that's because you're using me to work out your concepts, and that's fine. So, I mean, I'll turn the table on you. You can also just do close-ups and portraits, or you can see the whole context of it. It's something that you're aware of now, and it's good that you're aware of it. And to me, I just have it all. For myself, I can have it all if I can ever get out there to do it. And I like that feeling. Whichever possibility is there. Now, the strange thing that I want to say about this picture, I took about four or five photographs of her that are quite good. Maybe we'll see another one later on. But when I talk with people in Lima, wealthy people from the colonial upper class, they would talk about the Indians. They think the word Indian is not a good word, but it's a word. That they're so stoical, so cold, they have no feelings, they're like animals. That was the logic of their sequence, the sequence of their logic. They have no, they're so stone-faced, they don't reveal feelings, they don't have feelings. Like animals, they don't have feelings. They're like animals. And I would be in a rage inside, but I couldn't tell them how I felt about the people who were saying that thing. And so I have a series of photographs of this woman, just running through a range of emotional things, things that I can't even decipher. This is the almost abstract of her gaze here. It's just out there somewhere. And I'm very moved by that. And so I did have an agenda, but I never had a chance to talk about it until this morning. Thank you.
I'm looking at this in the book, and in fact, it's too bad you don't have these other three photos.
Oh yeah, the three are lined up. Yeah.
Are they in that slide?
No, they're in that book.
Yeah.
Some, not all of them.
Oh, it's too bad, because in fact, it's actually quite profound to look at the three different moods and then juxtaposed against this one.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until you told us the narrative about it, as somebody's board pointed out, your relationship with this one, the fact that she told you off. I would love it if that story, that narrative, were connected with, if that happened, then you took that photo. And then if that narrative had appeared there, I think it would actually be a really interesting examination of the ethnographer at work on lots of different levels. It's an ethnography as an ongoing relationship between two people. And I think it could have been just a wonderfully profound statement.
Well, I thank you for saying that. And I invite anybody else to do the same thing in their own work. But it's embarrassing that this is also so much about me. These are my own interior dialogues. These are the arguments that I have when I make this work. If it's interesting to you, then I
my question, I'm sorry, so my question is, I quickly was rereading this text, and I actually don't see that narrative that you told us in the text, in the book. Was there any reason for leaving it out, to contextualize that expression?
Well, I must have told some other story.
Oh, okay.
As a matter of fact, I think I implied that story on a couple pages earlier. But it's all too complicated. I mean, everyone uses as complicated as I am.
Mm-hmm.
We're just having a chance to take a scalpel. Let me open so you can hear some of this stuff. Next slide. This is a pre-Columbian pot of a man playing a bagpipe. I mean, that's what I saw when I saw the man. Of course, he was a man. And I remember things about him, but I think that most people would see this as that it evokes something very old, musicalized. Now, actually, since this is an ethnomusic class, these people play a bagpipe. In the Cusco area, they're the only people today who play bagpipes. Another part of over the mountains, another part of Peru nearby, they all play panpipes. But this panpipe has seven different notes in it. It's called Canchi Sipas, which means seven young unmarried women. And one, it's a double set of reeds, one here and another here. But you only play this side, you never play the other side, that's taboo. No. That's all that I can find out about, except they play at a festival, and it's the only festival I've not been able to document. where women sing songs for the female animals, and the words that go with this music, and the men play the bagpipes. Only men play the bagpipes, only women sing the songs. This is a lot of stuff. If I had more time, I would make a whole film about it. But it would need a whole year in fundraising, and no one would look at it. Yeah.
This photograph correspond with any recordings that are available?
Yeah. I got a recording of him. And he's on the cover of my Peru record as well.
Yeah, I thought maybe I'd recognize it.
Yeah. Turns out also that he was a shaman. The whole big shaman movement, people today in America, they want to hear about spiritual centers and energy centers and all that. And they go down to Peru and try to talk to the shamans. But I saw this guy curing somebody who had something wrong with him, and he would spit on his back and snap a belt over that. I had never seen any of the shamans who had come to America even refer to healing. They only do spiritual healing. There was a big conference of shamans in Washington, D.C. At the same time, my Peru show was there. So I had one of the shamans from Peru from this very region come over and see the show. And we're looking at the photographs, and of course, a picture of one woman, and started laughing. I said, what's the matter? I used to go out with her when I was younger. I said, she had a tough life. She was a friend of mine. I said, you know, her husband would leave her, and then she died, and her baby died. Said, we didn't have any kids. I mean, it was immediately a personal thing. And then, the next day, an anthropologist friend of mine went up to her, up to him, and said, at the conference, there's all this talk about these energy centers and energy things. Could you give me some other words in Quechua or other meanings for the word energy, that word? He said, you don't like work, like when you're digging potatoes. So he's talking about digging potatoes, and all these people are getting spiritual meaning out of it. That's fun. It's fun to realize that. Let's keep going. Next slide. I realized what I was doing. That time, what I was seeing was, it's a formalist analysis or something, but the shape of his hat, the shape of her hat, the shape of the house is the shape of an animal. But then the scale of their relationship to nature, how nature is inside of them and they're inside of nature. Next slide. Actually, this is based on a Peter Bruegel painting that I admired. I couldn't shake it from my mind. Have Peter Bruegel come across your mind while you're out there in the Andes is interesting. But they're planting potatoes. And she's barefoot, and that's snow. It's snowing. And he's turning the soil, and she puts a potato in. And I, as you saw before, we got a whole book about the designs on her back there. And I just like the formal relationship of being close to her and him being so far away at the same time. And all these little pellets on the ground, all these little things, the llamas, you know the animal, the llamas, well, they eat grass and they dung. And there's no trees up here. It's way up above the tree line. So the people gather the llama dung, dry it out, and they bring it down to the potato fields as fertilizer. So there's a lot of information in here, if you're interested in information. And I love that information. It's not information, it's just dynamics in the whole place. But all those things, I'm telling you, all these things go on at the same time. Next slide. I did a film about Peruvian weaving called Peruvian Weaving. Continuous warp for 5,000 years. Warp refers to the threads that go towards and away and back from the weaver. Those things that you see on her loom, those are the warps. And she puts the wefts across, weaving the warps and wefts. But a continuous warp, well, that's one piece of thread that goes round and round and round and round and makes up the fabric. That's in the technical term, that's called the warp, the weaving thread. But to me, and my film is about the fact that this approach, this style of weaving is the earliest style I found in 2000 BC on the coast of Peru. And it's remained all these years. How does it remain? already know how to spin it, and the mom is leaving and enjoying it. Next photograph. Yeah, I went and took lots of photographs of people doing their weaving. I took this one because it was nice, but I didn't really understand what it was till later. She has some chicha, which is corn beer that they make from the corn. They chew it and they let it ferment and they sleep on it for a while to get it to ferment, and then they make the beer out of it. And she's taking some corn beer, and before she starts to weave every day, she blesses the four corners of the world. She makes a blessing to the earth and to the sun. And that's pretty deep. And it's something that I was there to study technique, so I wasn't really tuned into this other dimension of it. But that would be called blessing with water. Okay. Are we okay? What time is class run to?
3:50. Oh, my better move fast.
Okay, we'll take a break at some point.
We'll take a break
about 3:30. Okay. Fine. Well, give us time to film. Okay, 20 minutes. Next photograph. How can I explain what she's doing? Anybody want to try to figure out what's in this photograph as I've talked so much? She's what? Counting stitches. In a way, the Peruvian fabrics are different from the fabrics that we wear. All the cloth that we have is made in the mill, long, long pieces. They cut the edges up. They have made hems on it. You know what a hem is? All Andean fabrics, the traditional ones, have no hems. All the edges are complete. They call the selvages. To do that, they start at one end of the loom and weave this far. And they turn the loom around and weave back the other way. So all the edges are complete. And then they finish the final passages, not with any loom parts at all, but one thread at a time. And that's what she's doing. Mm-hmm. That's an intelligence that I can't approach. I'll never learn to do that. That's why I took this photo. Next photograph. On the road. And here's me riding on the back of a truck, and I'm seeing that circle up in the hills. I see the same circle on his hat. See, that's the first photograph. Very selfish. Next photograph. Into town. What I like about this is formally the photograph is that it's like the same people twice. Like in a movie. Here they are, and then there they are again. Next. Oh boy, out in the street. A wedding. A big wedding, and the whole community comes out and dances in the street. This photograph got wrecked in the book because they made it into a double page spread and sliced out the guy in the middle. He's in the crevice in the book. Here he's kind of a fulcrum for this whole circle. And there's the sun going down again, another truck, but it's not poverty. They're so poor that they don't know it. What did I say? Somebody want to attack me for saying that? I deserve it. They're so poor they don't know. What did he say?
You're basically facing a standard of what wealth is, and you're saying it's like economic wealth, whereas I think a lot of these people have a greater richness that many of us would never really know or experience. So I think it's a very hypocritical sort of statement for us today.
Yeah, and I realize it as I said, because I'm totally devoted to their art and to what they do and how much they know that I don't know. All my life, every time I see something that drives me to some crazy corner of our society, I think of how they look at it. And it helps me immensely. Next slide. The power structure. And this picture didn't need a caption. It had its caption right in. How I felt about it. A bunch of turkeys. But actually, That band, this band is the mayor of Ayacucho, a city in the mountains. This is a leading manufacturer, and there's their two assistants, and there's the caption. Of course, when I took the picture, I thought of vultures. That's a subtext of the title, which is the context. And it's kind of mean of me, because I just had lunch with these guys, and I was taking a picture of the guys that I had lunch with.
Did the turkey just happen to wander in there?
Did they what? Well, they animals wandering out of the houses everywhere.
So it just happened to be on its way over
here? I guess. Or maybe they wanted to be in the picture. Nobody put them. I never did ask that question of them or of myself. Why are they there? I could go off on the subject of animals running around the house. That's not. Next slide. Yeah, this is one of those pictures that you can, like the very first picture, you can keep on interpreting it and not get anywhere. But on the way of trying to interpret it, you get to a lot of places. What questions come to mind?
What is going on?
Yeah, all right, that's a good question. What is going on?
Is that what
you're
starting?
What is the animal?
That's an animal, yeah.
A donkey, of course.
Pig.
Oh.
Where was it going with the pig? He clearly wasn't riding the pig.
Now, he had a rope to control the pig.
Yeah, the rope's behind the pig. Yeah.
Well, is he dead?
Is he just resting?
He's just resting.
He is?
He is?
I don't know.
His eyes are open.
His eyes, and he's, yeah. I think he's off balance.
I'm going to say whatever's in that backpack has caught up with him.
Is what?
It's caught up with him. He's
caught up with him.
He's down the top of it.
He fell over and his pig took off.
He fell over and his pig took off. That's the closest so far.
And he's looking at you being like,
going after
my pig.
He's looking at me and saying what?
Why are you going after my pig?
Why aren't you going after my pig? Actually, later we're picking the guy up and he goes over his pig. Yeah, he was, at the end of the day, I guess he had a good amount of drink, chicha, having worked, and he was on his way back home with this big burden. They all carry these big burdens, and I'm following him down the road, and he suddenly sees me with a camera. Oh, what to do? And then he got confused, fell over, the pig got away. It was an awkward moment, but it also reminds me of the fall of Daedalus. You know, I didn't think of it at that moment, but when I see the picture. And then this crazy dilemma that all these things have happened before and afterwards, and there's something going on there, and you're not really absolutely sure what they are. But if you go through this process like we just did, you end up with a good look at what life is like up there. Next slide. I was intrigued when I was taking the picture. I remember being intrigued by like a little shadow performance going on the ground. But when I printed the picture, I realized that the bottle was really nice. Yeah. By the way, as an ethnographer, how do you pay your informants? Or do you pay? Doesn't it spoil them if you pay them? Perform for you? Somebody puts a relationship into a money one. So what you do in the Andes is you buy a case of beer, put it down in front of the musicians, and when they play and they drink it, that's the deal. Next slide. He's carrying flour, you know? I could go on for a long time as to why fiddle and harp have become the traditional instruments of the Andean people. That stands for old music. But actually, they're both European instruments. But now, if you go to Peru or the Andes, fiddle and harp are the old stuff. I've written a whole book on the subject, but nobody wants to publish it. Next slide. This is a dance called the Huayno. Huayno. Great music. It's like hillbilly music in the Andes. Next slide. Yeah. These people have no emotions, they have no feelings. They never show their emotions, they're like animals. Next, yeah, thank you. I know I have a John Cohen photograph. What's strange, if any of you, you know, photographers, this is a. I couldn't tell how to expose the film because it was sunset, it was getting dark, and it was foggy out. And even though the trees were bent over, there was no wind blowing at all. And I was amazed at how some of that feeling comes across in the picture. All these. There's a good explanation for it, but it's not that interesting. Next slide. And this is at a festival up by Lake Titicaca, and this is how we look to them. This is their photograph of the white power structure, except for the guy in the back left who's a black man's mask. And I spent a long time trying to figure out what this photograph is. It's a dance of the old men. The old men also means the authorities or the respected figures. So it's making fun of the respected figures, it's making fun of the authorities. Also respecting them at the same time. But I also found a postcard from 1908 of a bunch of doctors going around to the villages in the Andes dispensing medicine, and they were all dressed in tuxedos like this. But apparently the same dance exists in Mexico. And so forth. Next slide. Wham! Bam! We'll end up before our break with this. This group of pictures from Appalachia. That's the music that I played, and in 1959, my band in Wall City Rapids was doing an album called Music from the Depression of the 1930s. America was prosperous at that time, and I wanted to experience, see what it was like to live in a depression, an economic depression at that time. And I had gotten some money from Life magazine for photographing Jack Kerouac in the Beat Generation. I used that money to go to Kentucky. And that's when I first met this wonderful guy, Roscoe Alton, who was there. And this was him going up to his house. Daisy, Kentucky. Next slide. We have to move a little faster. There's Roscoe when he came to visit me in New York. His wife complained about the other photographs, and why do you always show us in our work clothes and the dirt where we live? Why don't you show us in our ties? And so I did this picture. It's very strange for me to look at this picture because this is just a personal thing that happened. I used to live on a place called 71 Guy Street in Lower Manhattan, and they tore our loft down to make the World Trade Center. This photograph is taken in that loft, exact same space. That's photograph taken of a man known as Ground Zero. I don't know what that means, but it always comes to me when I look at this photograph. Next slide. Yeah. There it was. There was nobody there. I just took a documentary photograph of something that had just happened earlier. Next. Yeah, that's the picture I took of Roscoe when I first met him. And that photograph's been used a lot in records and books. It's come to support Appalachian music. Yes?
Was he a clawhammer player or a two-finger player?
Two-finger player. He could. He did do fretting as well.
He just kind of went back and forth.
Well, depending on which song it was, what was appropriate for dancing, he would use the frail to do a heavy rhythm thing. But to analyze his music, on that new record I did, I did analyze his music. The name of the new record of Roscoe Alton is called An Untamed Sense of Control. And that's what Bob Dylan said about it. That was Bob's observation of Roscoe's music years ago. He's very, very, very astute, and very descriptive. It's an untamed sense of control. If you really look at the music, it's totally disciplined, but when you first hear it, you can't figure out what the structure is. Next. This was like the next picture on the contact sheet after the previous one. He was explaining why he couldn't play so well because he works in cement all day. And he was showing me the cracks in his hands. so I, you know, he just showed me that I took a picture of it. And then years later, it becomes a very, I don't know, for me, evocative image, but I'm not sure what it evokes. That's what I end up liking about it. It's hitting something and showing something, but it's not that clear what that thing is. You can interpret what you want. Next. Mr. and Mrs. Sands. They made some nice recordings. She was a very powerful singer, she was. And his banjo playing was really strong. But you know, it's on the record, actually. You can just see their faces here. Next slide. Play to the land auction, where the old musicians come out, play old-time music, and all the old farmers come out and hear the old-time music, and they sell the farm tractors and all the stuff. They sell it all off. They sell off the land. So the accompaniment of these guys. That's Wade Ward and Charlie Higgins, if anybody knows about them. They're also on my record. They're also on There Is No I. Next slide.
Oh, you were standing right there. Which one are you?
What's that?
You were standing right there. Which one are you?
I was just beyond my... I was a major. I took the photograph because of the cracks in the paint. I thought it was just really like an old master. At the same time, it's such a strange statement. And I love the word used. It talks about... I don't know what I thought about. Next slide. Now, I wasn't studying how they put the harnesses on mules, but I did like the graphic quality of this, and also his family farming. In the little valleys in Appalachia. They probably still do. I know when I go home, back to my little valley in Appalachia, in New York State, I'll be doing that too. I keep the garden. Next slide. Grandma Pearly Davis. We heard her at Fiddler's Convention and then we went to visit her house and made some recordings of her. Next slide. Grandma Pearly Davis's house across the street. She still didn't believe in electricity. I think she didn't want to have electricity, so she had kerosene lamps. And I just like the chance to examine all those things that she used to live by. And also evoked a little bit of Walker Evans' old photographs from the FSA. Anybody know the FSA, the Farm Security Administration? There's a lot of people talk about it. I should control courses about that. Never mind, let's go on. Next slide. Here I was back in the Holiness churches again. And you can tell from the level of the camera that I was on the floor with everybody else. Next slide. They tore out the wall of a little house and made it into a bigger room to be a little church, a little Holiness church. That's Roscoe Place. I like those two little kids. Their parents, they can grow up into this. Next slide. Notice what the banjo's made of? Coffee can. The father made that for the kid. The kid wanted to have a banjo. And that was, there's the kid, listen. Tuning up. I wonder what kind of music he plays now. Essentially, it's bluegrass. So it was only time then, but it would be bluegrass now. Next slide. What's that?
Did you get that guy's name? That young man? Did you find out his name? Is it somebody?
I have no idea who he is or where he is. This man is dead, but his name is Sid Myers. Lives in Virginia. A beautiful, beautiful music. He would take fiddle tunes and reinterpret them onto the banjo. He's on my record. It's pretty funny because out of focus there is his wife and she's looking at the pictures in the middle of City Ramblers songbook. And my my daughter, on some of the recordings, she was only 6 months old and she's screaming. That's another level of meaning. Next slide. We'll get to Appalachia. Oh, there. There's a wonderful ballad singer, unaccompanied ballad singer. How do you photograph the music of an unaccompanied ballad singer? Somehow this photograph almost captures it. I don't know what he was trying to tell me about the power of God. I think he was talking about the power of God in his right hand. Anything a book called Cold Mountain by Charles Frazier? Charles Frazier has this picture sitting on his desk. He loves this kind of music, but he loves this picture because this guy reminds him of Samuel Beckett. Very interesting what happens to your work when you're out. More about Cold Mountain later. Next slide. To get to the other side. I have a healer, and she calls us when Abbey Road. But it did, that's all I think. You know, who decides musically? What's the sequence? Where's the black? Where's the white? Who makes that arrangement? It's very musical. Next slide. Yeah, there it is, a great background, and the little girls pasted on like a collage in front. I come back to this photograph over and over again, and I can't tell why. There's something I like about it. It's the outside of me. It really is. It's just that how, like, they're two-dimensional, and the space is three-dimensional. And then there's a strong wind blowing, it's kind of a little bit of a dust storm going. And there's the whole big landscape, and there they are. And I don't know. If you know, you please tell me. Okay, a few more, then we'll take a break. Two more. Next. Fiddler's Convention, Galax, Virginia. And this guy, he's proud of himself. He stands there really erect and plays his tune, and he's dressed up. You can see kind of all the old farmers around listening. Fiddler's conventions are amazing things. They're wonderful things. Because it's local music and it's local musicians, and I come and listen to each other. And I give each other prizes too. Next. Ed Robertson. First man to make a record of American country music in 1922. I heard that he was still alive in 1962, so I went out Texas to visit him, but this photograph made some recordings of him. Maybe someday Becky will play his recording of Sally Gooden, which is one of the most extraordinary things in the world. This guy, in 1922, phonograph records that there was none of country music, or his kind of fiddle music, and he was so proud of himself that he was invited to Nashville to play at the Confederate Soldiers Reunion, and from there he took a train up to New York. Went up to the Victor Studios and said, I'm good, recording. Well, let's hear you. Because you're good, but we don't have any category with you. But they recorded it anyway. It's incredible music. But he looks pretty happy with it, too. Next slide. What's odd about this is, I couldn't have planned it, I didn't see it. Prepared to meet that. Prepare to meet God, and the word God isn't complete. And then word of, and it's not complete again. And this is a man who just leads a bunch of goats around and travels all across the South. He did it for many, many years. I read in the Times 2 years ago. All across the South, they'd seen this guy. Next slide. Bill Monroe, the father of bluegrass music, by Courthouse Steps in Hazard, Kentucky. A cold Labor Day celebration in 1962. Next slide. Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs and the Foggy Mountain Boys, way back, 1959 or 60, maybe 58. At sunset, rising sun, New River Ranch, that's what it is. It's very interesting, there's a stream behind them. And painted on the wall is the screen. Now that, to me, is what pop art is all about. Next slide. Stanley Brothers, Some of you might know Ralph Stanley, the banjo from Brother Where Art Thou? Did you see that film?
Mm-hmm.
That's Ralph's voice on the Ku Klux Klan guy singing an old ballad. But he's a great singer and a great. I could talk about him the whole class. It would be so much deeper. Next slide. Okay, next slide. George Davis, a singing miner at Hazard, Kentucky. He had been a miner, then he became a radio program and sang all these songs about coal mining in Hazard, Kentucky, when I was there. He was the only one who had any songs about the Depression. Remember I said I went there to learn about the Depression? He wrote one called The Blue Eagle. He had known that the Blue Eagle was a symbol of the National Republic. NRA, which during the Depression everybody agreed to set prices and work hard so the nation could recover. Bet you nobody remembers that, but I had to find out about it. And it's next slide. Even went into little radio stations where the bluegrass guys would come on Saturday mornings to play their music, and you find the same thing in the Andes. The Indians come to the radio stations to play their music on Saturday. But they do it on Sunday morning. Next slide. Well, that's moving into Greenwich Village. That's young Bob Dylan in 1962.
Is that Ralph Rinsler?
Ralph Rinsler on the left and Johnny Harold on the right. Okay, let's go through a few more of that. This is one. Next. Wow. 1962. Do people still listen to Bob Dylan?
Oh, yeah?
Okay. Next slide. He was a kid just like you. Next slide. Let's see, I don't know where this goes. Woody Guthrie towards the end of his life. One more, Woody. Next slide.
Who's he watching?
What's that?
Who are the people playing?
Oh, it's a group called the Terriers, and they're playing in This Land Is Your Land, and he was towards, you know, his last years. And he had Huntington's chorea, which was uncontrollable jerks and kicks. And I only would show the photographs of him where I felt there was something of his inner stuff showing.
How old was he when he died?
How old?
Yeah.
I think he was in his 50s.
Was he?
Yeah, poor Woodford. Next slide. Yeah, this is when he was in Greystone State, when Bob Dylan came east to visit him. And that guy on the left is Jack Elliott, who's become rather well known of late. There's two guys hanging out. It's very interesting. Somebody bought a print of this a few years ago, because a man named Joel Cohen, C-O-E-N, and he bought it Ethan Cohen. For the guys who made that film, Brother Art Thou, the Cohen brothers. And they like this photograph enough. They're old folkies themselves. So I feel really connected. But more about that later. There's never an end to this. Next slide. Let's see where it goes. Oh, yeah. That's probably you. The folks drag you to a folks home concert. Next slide. Doc Watson's first visit to New York. How many of you know Doc Watson? Anybody? Okay. We had an organization called the Friends of Old Time Music, Ralph Rinsler and Israel Young and myself. We got together just to bring traditional performers to New York, people who'd never been heard before. And we put on Clarence Ashley, who brought this guitar player, Doc Watson with him. We did Roscoe Halkin, Bill Monroe, the Stanley Brothers, Mississippi John, Doc Bobs. I'm very proud of what we did. But it's faded away. Let's see, let's do one more slide. I'm getting hungry. Alice and Hazel. Hazel Dickens on the left, a great, great, great singer who sings experience of growing up Appalachian. Alice Girard, who loves that music and is the editor of Old Time. time. And they were the first two women who showed that women could sing bluegrass. Up to then, it was a male, man-only business, bluegrass singing. And all the men sang at the top of their voices, so imitating women. And suddenly, just two women. It was great. And actually, there's the heroes, the Stanley Brothers and Bill Monroe, all behind them. Next slide. Wow. Those are the founding fathers of the folk revival. You see here on the right, Alan Lomax in the center. Next slide. Muddy Waters. I was so surprised the National Portrait Gallery bought this photograph. I said, but there's thousands and thousands of photographs of Muddy Waters. Why are you buying? I said, well, it's a good photograph, and you did it. It's a photograph by John Cohen. This is outside of my realm to have that kind of.
Which harmonica player?
His name was Isaac Washington, and he just was from New Jersey, and he played this on this one gig. Next slide. Elizabeth Cocker. She's the woman who wrote that song, Freight Train. Anybody ever heard that one? Bass guitar tune. She wrote that when she was a little girl. And then she was working with a senior family in Washington. The night in Peggy Senior Rain, she could play the guitar. And they learned that song from her. Which then traveled around the world. One more picture of Elizabeth playing the banjo. With a fifth string on the lower side, and she's left-handed. So what are we doing with banjo? We know banjo.
And the photo is reversed?
What's that?
And the photo is reversed?
This photo is, this photo is reversed. I don't know why. It's like a daguerreotype. You know what a daguerreotype is? There's lots of daguerreotypes of banjo players with the fifth string down, because the daguerreotype is always reversed. And guys wanted to have the left hand holding the thing.
So they did it.
They did it backwards so that it looked like a daguerreotype. Next slide. Next slide.
This is converted.
In 1957, on McDougal Street in New York City, a bunch of guys jumped ship from England, and they were playing a new kind of music called skiffle. That's the kind of music that John Lennon listened to when the Beatles started. This is about 5 years before the Beatles. 6 years before the Beatles. Okay, let's take a break.